Friends, welcome to church this morning. If you are like relatively new, I want to add my welcome to the previous welcomes. I'm relatively new also. It can be a strange thing coming into a new community. For those of you who have been here for a long time, there are a lot of things that are sort of like normal for you that you maybe are used to. But if you're coming over the first time, I mean, it can be a bit strange and, you know, I mean, just look around at some of the people here, right? I mean, it's just a joke. But you know, if you are here, so it's like your first couple of weeks or something, and you're just sort of feeling out the community. One thing that I sort of hope you feel, and I'm sure everybody in the church would endorse too, is that you feel the welcome first and foremost of God. God is welcoming you into this place today, and that He's got just deep love for who you are. He sees your journey. He knows where you've been. He knows all those bits, and He's welcoming you into this place. And so if you feel any welcome from the people around here, because 60% of the folks in here are fabulous, if you feel the welcome from those folks, you're probably just feeling a little extension of the welcome of God, and we hope that is sort of your experience here today. I know I have felt that welcome since being here, so join the club. Well, we're here in the Epistle of James. We've been going through James. I think this is our fourth or fifth week. The title of my message today is Completing Faith. Completing Faith. So if you leave with nothing else in your head or your heart, leave with that little phrase. It'll probably help you tie the sermon in. Or maybe even remember it, you never know. Completing faith. I want to begin today by sort of zooming out to 30,000 feet, because I think you got to zoom out to 30,000 feet and sort of look at this thing from the top and try to get the lay of the land again before we sort of dive into a text like this. Because if you forget sort of where you are, you can get... This is one of those texts where you can sort of become obsessed about the bits, you know, the little bits. I mean, this during the Protestant Reformation, this was a big one. Martin Luther had big problems with this text. I mean, he seemed to get over it, and I'm glad he got over it. But just there are some things in this text that we could get lost in, and we could obsess about, and we could miss. You know, sort of the bigger picture, not just the bigger picture of James, but the bigger picture of the scriptures. What is the narrative that we're supposed to be finding ourselves in? We could miss the tree, we could get obsessed with the trees and miss the forest. And so I want to zoom out before we start, and then I'm going to zoom out again when we end to remind us. But just as a reminder, you know, in Genesis, I'm not going to go through the whole Bible, but well, maybe a bit of it, but in Genesis, we're introduced to a God who does not just create human beings and give them a set of propositions to remember. We don't just get a set of propositions for God. Rather, we are sort of inducted into this big, huge cosmos, everything that exists. And this cosmos is supposed to be a theater where God's love and God's action with us plays out. Human beings were called to participate with God in the cultivation of the earth, cultivation of the cosmos, to work alongside Him to bring about flourishing and an ordered world. This is the big sort of picture. Believing, you know, an intellectual assent to the lordship of the Creator is not the whole picture of everything that we're called to do. The church's existence is not just about believing a set of propositions and then we're all good. You know, then, now we've got our sort of fire insurance, you know, and then one day when the Lord decides to act again, He sort of whisks us off into the sky and that, you know, and then we leave all the other rotters here behind, and that's really what the faith is all about, you know. We got our ticket. We believe the right things. Well, that's a very truncated, shrunken, very unhelpful vision of the Christian faith. It's too small. It's way too small. The gospel is about the whole cosmos, everything that exists. So the gospel includes personal salvation, yes. But what is at stake in walking the way of Jesus is much bigger than your individual personal life. It is. We tend to be individualists. But this is not just, the Christianity is not your own personal self-help religion that sort of gets you through a few emotional bumps, and then that's all that there is until someday we're sort of caught up in the sky with Him in the great by and by. I didn't even mean to rhyme there, but it just sort of comes out, doesn't it? I mean, that was all for free. You don't even have to tithe for that. So the gospel includes within itself, with the redemption of your person, it includes healing for the structures of society and the brokenness and chaos that we find in creation. It's big. It's magnificent. It encompasses everything. Your work, your family, everything, all of those bits find a home within the gospel. Part of the Jesus story is that there is a need for us to participate with God in the healing of the world. And this is part of what we do, as James has even said, as the first fruits of this new creation. The first fruits of this new creation. So we're sort of like a foretaste of what is to come. We've been talking a little bit over the last few weeks about this sort of already, Jesus is already died and been resurrected, and one day He will come again. And we sort of live in the middle, and we're like a little foretaste of what is to come. We're like sort of the teaser, you know, when you go for a wine tasting, you get that little bit, you know, at the beginning, and then sometimes it makes you want more because it tastes so good. Well, we're kind of like that foretaste, that little touch on the tongue of the world's taste buds that creates a longing for more. And we participate with God in that new creation now. We do. This is part of what your work is about. This is what your family is about. Participating with God in new creation. This is what our friendships do. They give us a little taste of the new world. So faith in the one Creator God revealed in and through Jesus calls us not to just believe some ideas, but to participate with God in the healing and renewal of the world. That's kind of the big picture scope of what's going on in the text of Scripture. And the Epistle of James exists within this vision. It's got a part to play within this vision. A vision that says that faith or deep trust in Jesus expresses itself concretely. It's supposed to touch the ground somewhere. If it sort of just exists in the intellectual realm and it doesn't become concrete in our actions, there can be a danger in the church of, you know, what I'm going to call believism. Well, I believe it and that's enough. Well, not really. It's so much bigger. And you know what? I just think a sort of believism kind of faith is just terribly boring and irrelevant. Just on a real practical note, forget all the theological reasons why we should move out of believism, you know, just sort of an intellectual assent to religion. Beyond all that stuff, I mean, it's just boring. I mean, what do you do with the rest of your life when you're not here having me fill your head with a bunch of information? I mean, it just is totally irrelevant. It actually becomes very meaningless. And I think one of the reasons why people struggle with faith is meaninglessness. They don't know what it means for their daily life or what it means for the world around them. But the Christian faith definitely holds these two things together. And it's only when the Christian faith malfunctions that we see these things pulled apart. But James is encouraging us to think about this stuff, to think about the nature, the kind of belief that we hold. He says, you really got to think about it when it's void of concrete expression. You got to think about the nature of that faith. The goal for James is to, yes, be deeply intellectual, to believe something, but to be deeply concrete at the same time. These things should not be pulled apart. These two elements should be held together. And when they are not, you know what happens? When they're not held together, we become sort of like intellectual gluttons. You know, we get our heads filled up with all kinds of ideas, and it's really sad, but when we get our head full of all these ideas, all these propositions, all these doctrines, and it doesn't have expression in our daily life, sometimes we even come to believe that we've somehow possessed the fullness of faith, and that's really actually quite dangerous in many ways. It's dangerous for our evangelism because nobody gets to see Jesus with skin on them. On him, you know, they never get to actually like touch what the gospel looks like worked out in daily life. So that becomes a little bit unhelpful. But we don't want to be intellectual gluttons, right? We don't want to just sort of compile a whole bunch of information in our heads. That information is good. Belief is good. Belief in essential things is good. But James calls us to think about the nature of that belief, and part of that is going, okay, what does this mean for the world around us? What does this mean for the world around us? So in the Christian vision, it is impossible, actually, in a proper Christian vision, to talk about faith without talking about the peace, order, flourishing of the whole world. This is God's good world, and right at the beginning, you know, those first couple chapters of Genesis, they sort of follow this idea that the whole creation is like God's temple, a place where he wants to come and reside, where he exists. He wants to fill this whole temple, all of creation, with his glory. You want to talk about a big vision that includes your whole life. Oh boy, you find it in Genesis, definitely. But we can't really talk, we shouldn't talk about the faith that we find in the good Creator God in and through Jesus. We shouldn't talk about that apart from our actions. James is concerned about this. For instance, you cannot talk about faith and ignore the poor. This is very important for James. You ignore the poor while talking about faith, you've missed something. You cannot talk about faith and leave the orphan orphaned. That's a malfunction of faith. You cannot talk about faith and knowingly participate in corruption in business, because it's an unhelpful outworking of the gospel. It's a malfunction. It's not just that you've been a bad person. It's that God's big vision to fill the earth with his glory is being truncated and shrunken by your actions. It's not just a big God in the sky with a bat getting ready to smack all those who are morally a bit defunct. It's bigger than that. It's more important than that. It's about peace, order, flourishing, coming to the whole cosmos. It's this big vision. Okay. So, now back to James. We've got to keep this stuff in our heads when we're talking about this. James begins his section that we're in today by proposing a question. And it's really about the nature of faith, the kind of faith that we have. This question is kind of like, is this the kind of faith and trust? Is this kind of faith and trust that we put in Jesus the kind of faith and trust that can be lived without works? Is that the nature of this faith? Are those two things compatible? And of course, James emphatically says, no. The kind of faith and trust that we put in Jesus is the kind that issues or expresses itself in works. It becomes something in the real world. It doesn't stay as a set of intellectual propositions in our head. It becomes something in the real world. So the illustration he uses about telling a poor person to be warm and well fed, but not helping them when it's within your power to do so, is a way of saying this. He's basically saying, listen, friends, the faith that we hold in Jesus is not just a bunch of well-wishing. It's not saying nice things. It's intended to heal the world. It's intended to heal the world, and you're part of that. There's a sense for James, even in this first bit, that faith might exist, but that it has no life, or that it can have no life. It can be dead. So it's like you can say, you can look at a corpse and say, it exists, but it doesn't mean it's functioning like it's supposed to be functioning. Saint Bernard said this in a sermon. He said, just as we know the life of the body through its movements, we come to see the life of faith through good works. The body is given life by the soul through which it moves and feels. Just as the body dies when the soul leaves it, faith dies when the ardor of charity is cooled. When we stop working out the love of God in the real world, faith begins to shrivel up and die. For James and St. Bernard, it's impossible to have faith in Jesus without that faith expressing itself in concrete actions. It is about as helpful as a dead corpse. About as helpful as a dead corpse. It exists to some degree, but one must really wonder about its usefulness. He's not saying faith does not exist in a person that has no works. But he's asking about its usefulness. Is it fulfilling its intended purpose? Faith without works leaves us longing for more. James is saying there must be more. There must be more. Verses 18 and 19, James continues to push against this idea that belief, kind of mental assent to doctrine, is enough. He's pushing against this. And he suggests that if we were trying to prove faith, it is very hard to do, almost impossible, unless it can be witnessed through the lens of a life lived. It's almost impossible to prove faith without works. Again, it doesn't mean that faith isn't there. But how can our faith be evident, James asks, if it's not through works? To illustrate this, James highlights a fundamental piece of doctrine that any Jew would assent to, any Jew and any Christian would assent to. The Jewish creed that was spoken every day by faithful, devout Jews was known as the Shema. And the Shema is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one." This is like fundamental belief. No good Jew or Christian would argue that this is not one of the most fundamental beliefs that should be held in our minds and in our hearts. It sits close to the heart of everything. Sort of in some ways, a summary of faith. So James says that you can believe this most fundamental doctrine, and you can believe that it is good, but he makes his point by saying that even the demons believe that piece of fundamental doctrine, and they shudder. So somehow believing it in our heads is not quite good enough. He's saying, does it appear to be doing any good for them to simply mentally assent to this idea? Does it appear that it's doing any good for those demons to hold this belief? Doesn't appear that way. Now, it is very possible, you know, as I sort of read and meditated on this text, that James is being a little bit cheeky. This is sort of like a Jamesian burn. I don't know if that's a real thing, but I think he's being a little bit cheeky. This is a bit of an underhanded, sarcastic burn. This is my opinion, and the opinion of a few others, who I think are obviously very intelligent people. You see, I think probably what's going on here is James is saying something like, you know, those demons, they're shuddering. What does that mean? They're responding. They have actions that are corresponding to their beliefs. They seem to be doing even more than you, the hearers of my epistle. He's provoking them. Well, that's what I think anyways. I think it's there. It's a provocative statement. James is saying, is it possible, you who are not walking out your faith by actions, is it possible that the demons understand faith better than you? Yikes. Moving right along. So James is saying belief, even in the most fundamental points of doctrine, is not proof of genuine faith. It might be there, faith might be there, but it might just be a corpse. James moves on to contrast those demons who seem to have right belief, and he speaks of two examples that every Jew would agree with, of right belief mixed with right action. He talks about Abraham and Rahab. And these are examples of the nature of the kind of faith that is saving faith. Saving faith. So verses 20 to 26, James chooses these two examples of faith to highlight the nature of true faith and its expression in action. So Abraham was arguably the most central character of the Jewish faith and Christian faith. He was a father to them all. They deferred to Abraham. He was well known by every Jew for his painful and sacrificial faith. You remember the story about Abraham and Isaac, where he was going to give up that which he loved to obey the commandment of God? Now, I don't want to get into the idiosyncrasy of that passage. That is a real doozy. You might want to go home and read it, though. It'll shock you a bit. If you've never read the Bible, I mean, there's a real bell ringer to start with. If you never read the Bible, start in Numbers. It's just quite a read, you know? Yeah, and if it just doesn't feel really inspiring to you, I'm sorry. I mean, the rest of us find it riveting. Anyways, sorry, that was a bit cheeky too. But Abraham was this example of sacrificial faith. Rahab, she was kind of from the other side of the spectrum in some ways. I mean, because Rahab was actually a prostitute. So not exactly a moral exemplar in some people's minds. But Rahab, in spite of, you know, the life that she was living, lived out concrete faith. She lived out faith by her actions in hiding the spies and lining herself up, lining her actions up with the will of God. So you got these two really interesting examples. So Abraham's actions were painful and sacrificial. Rahab's were frightening and risky. These are really good definitions of what it feels like to walk by faith. It may be that James is calling his hearers, whoever they were, to act when it is sacrificial, painful, frightening, or risky. And this makes sense when we look at the first couple chapters, or the first chapter of James. These people are in the midst of sacrificial, painful, frightening, and risky situations. James is holding these people up, Abraham and Rahab. In this little part about Abraham and Rahab, we're also introduced to something that is really key in understanding what faith is. In this passage, the word completed is used when it speaks about Abraham's faith. James says, "You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was completed by his works. And this word completed is really important. I've said it a few times, but if it sort of hasn't sunk in, or if it's raising questions for you about the nature of faith, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist when action isn't there. But there is a real sense for James that it might exist, but that it's not fulfilling its intended purpose. The word completed is important because it's a form of this word telos, which means an end goal, the direction that something is intended to travel. What James is trying to get us to see here is that faith and works are not two separate things. You don't just sort of get some faith and then you try to add a bit of works to it. Somehow, it's like a continuum. One sort of seamlessly moves in and out of the other. They're one and the same. See, genuine faith has a direction that it's intended to go. It's like a seed. You know, a seed that hasn't been sort of planted in the ground, might not go anywhere. But when it's planted and the conditions are sort of right, that seed begins to sort of grow up into something else. And if the seed doesn't grow up into something else, you would say, well, that's a defunct seed. I don't know what you'd say about it. But the seed has an intended direction. It has an intended purpose. And speaking of Abraham's faith as completed gives us this sense. You know, remember before in James we were talking about this word, you know, the message, the story of Jesus that's been planted in our hearts by the Spirit. We've already got this language of something being planted. And that thing that's planted, the intention for it is to grow up into something. There's an intended direction of travel for that thing which has been planted in us. There's a telos. Somewhere this thing is all going. So for James, this thing that is planted should be growing into something. Now, when faith is not expressed in risky, sacrificial, painful, or frightening action, this doesn't mean it doesn't exist, but it could be like a seed not fulfilling its intended purpose. James tells us that effectively, without action, it's dead. It's like a body with no animation, no life in it. So friends, James has told us that there's been a word planted in us through the story of Jesus by God's Spirit, which is intended to grow up and into fruitful works in the world. This is the intention, to grow up into fruitful works in the world. For James's church, there's a deep concern with one of the fundamental aspects of faith's expression, which is the way that we relate to and care for the poor. This is one of the concerns that James's church has. And as we learned last week, we have to be careful about how our faith expresses itself. We cannot express our faith with partiality, with deference to people because of their outward and external merits. We shouldn't judge the clothes. We have to be careful about those externals. So that's sort of a very concrete expression for James, but I think we can extrapolate this principle out further to think about any aspect of life where our faith might be dormant, where it's not fulfilling the purpose it was designed for. Where it's not sort of fulfilling or coming to fruitful expression in the world through concrete action. So as I began with, the Christian faith is intended, remember all that stuff I mentioned about Genesis? The Christian faith is intended to manifest itself in the healing of the world. Essentially what James is calling the church to, that he's talking to, is to participate with God in the healing of the world by service and partnership with the vulnerable. Participating with God in care for the poor. But this principle touches every area of our lives too. It touches our family, our workplace, the way that we participate in politics, the way you treat your spouse and your kids. James encourages us today to consider what it looks like for the seed of faith to reach its end, to be completed by the way that we live it out in the world. James is encouraging us to think about completing faith. Not this dichotomous faith where you've got beliefs in your head that are never expressed in action, but a faith that's got some continuity because it finally completes itself by being expressed in your real life in concrete ways. That's the challenge that we find in James today. Let me pray. Lord, I would be the first to say that I don't always know how to walk out what we've just heard from James. But I recognize this morning, Lord, that our faith is supposed to manifest itself in concrete action in the world, in our workplaces, with our families, in our relationships, the way that we treat all kinds of people. And so I, and I'm sure others in this room, Lord, are just asking for help. By your Spirit, you would remind us, and that you would teach us how to do this as a community. Lord, that we would be concerned about concrete action in the world, and that here at TAC we would have fruit. We would have fruit, that our lives would bear fruit in the world. And that the faith, Lord, that you've deposited in us would come to its intended end. And that to walk in Alliance Church would participate with you in the healing of the world. Lord, make us those kind of people. Help us where we fall short. Remind us. Help us to remind each other. Amen.